From the Land Grant University in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 7th day of August. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. We'll hear from yesterday's crop physiology field day about the corn root ball and how fertilizers are impacted by their placement. And then we'll turn our attention to the weather forecast. Eric Snodgrass will be here too on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Mike Zuzulo at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas, now joins us to take a look at the marketplace. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you, Todd. Happy Friday. Happy pre-WASDE report weekend.
Yeah. What else is news? Anything?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think was a big market mover that didn't get a lot of press this week, and the reason I think it was a big market mover is because we saw a really sharp increase in the price of gold and silver. Gold was up 7%, silver up 10% so far on the month now after this week's close. And we saw the wheat market really kind of fall apart until the end of the week on Friday. I think part of that was the crude oil market being a lot weaker than normal. But I think the other part of it is the Russian ruble being down almost 5.5% over the past 2 weeks. And so what I'm connecting the dots right now with, and trying to at least, Todd, is outside the WASDE report, we've got the potential that this Senate bill that just got passed from the now deceased Senator Graham on the Russian sanctions passing the Senate Friday, I think has been built into the trade through the weaker currency by the Russian ruble. And I'm wondering whether the gold and silver markets haven't become safe havens again and the dollar weakens again, in part because part of the sanctions bill has to do with, I think, the top five or seven importers of Russian oil. President Trump also added, and it passed, an Iranian sanctions bill. So it's essentially targeting 100% tariffs, as I read it, on imports of Russian or Iranian oil. That would directly hit not just Russia, but also China. And I think that could have been part of the reason why the soybeans were also a little bit weaker here this week, is because of the policy side of the equation. So that's something I'm definitely putting out there on the shelf as I get ready for the WASDE report.
Because I didn't talk to you last week and we're talking policy and currencies, what did you think of the Japan-U.S. purchase of the yen?
Yeah, this is a situation where what Asia is suggesting right now is that Secretary Bessent came in and helped support and intervene directly with the Japanese, very similar to what we did at the Plaza Accord in 1985. So that 1980s back to the future mindset still very much forefront in my mind as I get ready to do. I'm actually going to be doing a meeting in Illinois next month, and we'll talk about that specifically. But getting back to your question, the Asian press, the Asian analysts are suggesting that was due in part because the market, currency market in Asia, was very nervous that between the South Korean stock market decline of almost, I think, 8 or 9 or 10% in one night or two nights, and then the currency, the Japanese yen, hitting, you know, 35, 40-year lows, this was going to create a system-wide, a systemic currency run in Asia, and they wanted to prevent that. So it's a big deal. Again, one of those things didn't get a lot of press. Good job seeing a heads up on it.
Now, turn your attention to the thing you started with, which is the WASDE. That's due out next week, and it'll be the first time we also have a crop production report for corn and soybeans.
Yeah, the big thing for me is going to be matching up acreage yield and demand domestically and giving us fresh ending stocks numbers. And the survey that I'm doing right now, and we'll have completed by this afternoon, and then I'll add to some of my extra satellite imagery analog stuff that I do to complete my model for yield determination this weekend. I'm leaning towards keeping my yield about 180, still about 180 on the corn. My 51 yield, 51 and a half yield on beans might go up based upon the survey. So both sides of the Corn Belt, east and west of the Mississippi, are kind of generally saying pretty concretely they feel like the corn is there. It's a good crop, but they're worried about tar spot. They're worried about southern rust. They're worried about the springtime. One guy on US 50 specifically down close to Effingham told me this week that his ears are the smallest he's seen in many, many years. He's just not going to have it this year because of the springtime. And so I get this impression that the corn could really be stunted as far as upward yield trajectory, whereas the beans Clients are suggesting they've got a lot of pods. They've got some really good potential if this finishes out strong.
What do you expect on the global side of the WASDE figures?
Yeah, this is probably the most important thing of the report, other than the cattle numbers as far as steer prices for Q3 and Q4 in light of Mexico and in light of the biannual numbers. But we're seeing still in France an export price of 770 a bushel in corn, 640 in Romania, 570 in Ukraine, and 540 in the United States at the Gulf of America. I think we need to migrate the U.S. and Ukrainian price up towards France and Romania. The near-term weather models are suggesting heat and dry weather are going to likely hit Ukraine or parts of Ukraine the next 10 days. I think that could clip yield. And logistically, with the USDA Ag Attaché coming out with a fresh report this week saying, I'm going to put Ukraine production up on corn, but I'm going to almost halve their exports because of logistics and war and play it like 2022. That was big news that trade really didn't sink its teeth into because I think it just came in and nobody really looked at that report.
Yeah, so that would be big news if it was like 2022. That would be for wheat too. Given the issues that clearly he has defined in the Black Sea area, coupled with what's happening in the Middle East, there could be some real hunger issues, I would think, in that part of the world.
Yeah, in the World Trade Organization, the United Nations FAO, they're talking about this, but it's really interesting to me and kind of disappointing to me. The trade just wants to keep trading these headline news, and I think they're going to have to rethink both the corn number globally, the wheat ability to export. I think Russia put on a pretty large and hefty export tax on wheat. I just saw that, so I don't know too much about it. But then you talk about the crude oil and the issue with the Strait of Hormuz. I don't think that's going to get straightened out probably until after the midterm elections at this stage. So I think the trade's going to have to do a massive rethink at some point. Will it be and come together after the WASDE report? It should, in my opinion, because time is of the essence because of what you just said.
We'll have to keep an eye on it. Thank you much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Todd. Take care, sir.
You too. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's at globalcommresearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Yesterday, the crop scientist here on campus invited folks in to visit with them at the Physiology Field Day. Connor Sybil helps to organize it. It is now in its fifth year, and that program, he says, is still growing.
It is. So we call it a Crop Physiology Field Day. We put talks, myself, Dr. Fred Bilo, but our graduate students as well. They get to highlight their research, the findings. We speak to farmers, industry agronomists, CCAs. We've had great attendance. It keeps growing, as you mentioned. Last year we broke 200, and we're pretty sure we broke 200 people again today. Just getting latest and greatest on what we're seeing in corn, soybean yield studies.
And what kinds of things were you showing them today? And I say you, but I mean you of the lab.
Yeah, so the team has some important topics. We're talking a lot about boron, getting a lot of questions about that lately. We're talking about strip till and hybrid management, rooting architectures. And then we also have some information on nutrient requirements, corn and then soybean, and we're ending it with soybean. And this year, for the first time, you mentioned 5 years, we're known for corn and soybean, but we have wheat on the docket as well. And so talking a little bit about our wheat agronomy research at the same time.
Of these, what do you think farmers can walk away with? What is most likely they'll be able to put in their back pocket and use?
And that's the way we set the presentations up. They're about half just background and information because, as you well know, every farmer does things a little differently. And so we don't have the silver ticket or golden ticket about exactly how to do it. But what we like farmers to walk away with is knowledge about that topic, whether it's a nutrient or a practice like strip tillage. Give them thinking about, okay, from what I heard today, how does that apply to my acre, or what might I need to tweak to make it work for me that was a little different from the research project approach? But that's our goal. Get the farmers thinking about it, how they apply that to their acre, and then they know their farms better than anyone else. They'll figure out how that may or may not be a next step they try.
It seems to me one of the things that they might be able to walk away with is the root architecture discussion that took place. Why was that decision made to look at how the root ball, the root mass develops, and if it makes a difference to where the fertilizer is placed?
Yeah, so it's sort of the last unexplored frontier. I mean, we've been looking at roots more indirectly. You know, you can put tubes in the ground and measure certain spots, but we're looking at whole root systems now, largely because we focused on the above ground and there's interest on the below ground. But the reason it's exciting is there's huge variation, which means if you can put hybrid A in management A, you might get a really good response. You put it in management B and it may not respond. You go, why? Probably related to the roots, because that's where nutrients are taken up. And why it's really exciting on the extension side and for farmers, they don't have to change anything on the farm necessarily other than grabbing a different bag of seed. And that's where we like doing research and looking at questions where it's not a huge investment change or anything like that. It's just better understanding how do you farm. So genetic A might be better for you, but your neighbor who farms a little differently might get more out of their system with genetic B. And that's why it's exciting.
And they can find farmers, and others that is, can find some of this information on the Crop Physiology Lab website?
Yes, cropphysiology.cropsci.illinois.edu. And we do have our reports on the homepage.
Connor Sybil is a crop scientist on the Urbana-Champaign campus at the University of Illinois and one of the driving forces behind the Crop Physiology Field Day. Jared Finder is with us. He's a researcher that took a look at the architecture of the corn root and how that corresponds to where fertilizers might be placed in the soil profile. I want to follow up on some of the things that you presented to those who were present today, a couple hundred folks in the tent, because it really felt like there was useful information for producers that they could put into their operations right away, just based on the hybrid that they might plant and how it's paired with where their fertility or fertilizer placements take place.
Yes, one of our trials here is looking at hybrid placement on different tillage types and also fertility placements within that. So we know that growers are going to kind of be setting their ways. Whether a guy's broadcast, he's probably going to stick to broadcast. If somebody adapted to strip till, they're probably going to stick to it once they have paid the input costs and everything else for that. So we're trying to figure out what hybrids will grow the best for those already in place managements, and then help growers improve on that by picking the right hybrid that will have the below ground rooting structure to help find that fertilizer, depending on how they place it and everything else. That way we can get more nutrients into the plant because the roots are going to be there, and then in turn increase our yield and increase our fertilizer use efficiency through that.
I know you've done the research. Farmers will most likely just eyeball this. Yeah. So how is it that they go about, you know, going to the field and looking at a root or choosing a hybrid that matches their fertility program based on their production practices?
So what I suggest growers to do, and actually first it starts with the seed companies. There are a few seed companies that are starting to place recommendations on their rooting structures. Bex is a large front runner for this, but some of the other companies are starting to follow up on placing their roots on whether it be broadcast or just simply saying how they grow. But now in this day, what I'm suggesting to growers is if you plant 10 different hybrids on your farm, go dig a few plants from each one of those 10 hybrids. Look at the differing root structures that you have, because you're probably not planting one field of strip till, one field broadcast, and no fertilizer in the other field. You're probably farming them all the same way, so we're going to treat them all the same. And then that's when you can look at the key rooting differences between those hybrids, use that information to look at, and then when you get your seed guide earlier in the fall, remember what they look like. Take your yield monitor, for example, and then start making those decisions on how can we improve matching our fertilizer placement with the hybrid rooting structure.
I do have a quick question on this, and it is related to no-till and having a larger mass? I can't quite remember.
Smaller mass,
closer to the surface. Do we know if that also correlates with its ability to survive dry conditions, and does that make much of a difference?
That is a very good question on the survivability of having a smaller rooted hybrid. Actually, if we back up 10 years ago when we classified hybrids, a lot of people just classified them as either offensive or defensive, or racehorse or workhorse. So your racehorses were typically your smaller rooted hybrids, to where they would not stand drought as well, because they had the smaller root. They didn't have good water finding ability because they didn't have that root mass or the surface area with root hairs to find that water. And so that is why the smaller rooted hybrids, which would be typically your racehorse hybrids, your top end yield producers, are benefiting from placing that fertilizer with a no-till scenario or a scenario that places it very shallowly in the soil, because those roots don't have the mass or the root hairs to find it out in the soil themselves. So matching where you place it into relation to that rooting structure is where we're kind of matching the two together and picking up large swings of yield differences.
Jared Fender is a University of Illinois crop scientist. He made a presentation during this week's Crop Physiology Field Day on how the size, shape, and mass of the root ball of a corn plant affects its ability to take up nutrients under different cropping conditions. In the example cited, a small shallow-rooted corn plant is better equipped to capture nutrients broadcast over the top of a no-till field. Let's check in on the weather forecast now. Eric Snodgrass is here from Nutrien Ag Solutions in Diagrable. Hi, Eric. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, you bet.
Let's start with the rainfall we've had, the rainfall we didn't have, and the rainfall we might have. A lot of rain, I guess. I don't know. At least for this time of year, it feels like.
Well, it's the most... As a meteorologist, summer is the most disappointing time of year to hope that you can forecast accurately, especially precipitation. And it's because our models are not designed to handle it. They do what we call parameterization of convection. What that means is they cannot simulate the storm inside of some of our big models we like to. So we always toss around like, oh, the European model or the US model called the GFS. And those models have to parameterize convection. They cannot simulate it. So what does that mean? Well, how does all of our summer rainfall get here? It's usually through convection, thunderstorms. And these models are doing their best just to even think about getting it right. And so it's very maddening to see the weather forecast change so rapidly. And you're right. Earlier this week, rain that came through parts of Iowa and Missouri, I thought would be more in Illinois. But I'm kind of glad it didn't get here. We had some parts of Iowa that picked up 5 inches. And there's around Columbia, Missouri, some places got 6 to 7 inches of rain. And that's the way the rainfall's been distributed. Very hyper-local. If you got rain, you got a ton of rain. If you didn't get rain, you're just counting up days since the last time it rained and the drought continues to grow, which, by the way, nationally, we're still sitting at 70% of the United States in some stage of drought, and that includes the abnormally dry category. So yeah, Todd, it's been frustrating. And then I look at the forecast, I'm like, all right, we're going to see a ridge develop over Texas, high pressure down to our south. We should expect to see ridge riding clusters of storms for the next couple of weeks. And, you know, if that comes through, we should be getting rain. But the only thing that makes me want to put a bit of a stamp of guarantee on rain is that the state fair is coming up. And almost every year, there's something that washes out the state fair. So I don't know. Maybe that's the only proof that we can forecast something right, is if there's a big event coming.
Yeah, fair time comes and there's always a rainfall, no matter whether it's a county fair or a state fair. At least one day, there's something that just showers that dump a lot of rain. Now, the question is, how localized are those, and are there enough of them that in the end, everybody gets something? And what do you think about that?
See, that's the question. I don't think it is something where everybody gets the rain. Some of our forecast models are like, you know what? Everywhere from eastern Iowa all the way to Ohio, we got plenty of rain, maybe a chance of 1 to 2 inches in the next 2 weeks. But then we see those forecasts and they all look blended and smooth, and then the rain comes through and it's really local. I would say this though, Todd, if you don't get the rain you want, okay, at least we're not going to be compounding that with heat. You know, July came in and finished pretty hot in the Western Corn Belt. Based on some yield modeling, we would expect to see their temperatures, which averaged in July 2 to 5 degrees above normal in the Western Corn Belt. That should peel off about 5 bushel from the entire region. I mean, there's several states in there. But the Eastern Corn Belt, we got hot, but we avoided long duration excessive heat. And now we're in August and the temperature forecasts are pretty cool going forward for what they can be this time of year. So if you don't get the rain, at least we're not compounding it with incredibly hot temperatures, giving us that flash drought scenario. All of that risk is going to be way down in the Southern Plains in Texas and Oklahoma for the next 2 to 3 weeks.
This is the time of the year where the old saying actually works, where it says rain makes grain, grain fill with rain is the best in the world. So,
oh, yeah.
Hopefully there'll be some folks out there that do get good rainfall across crops that can continue to be in decent shape. What else are we talking about this week, actually?
You know, I just you're going to start to see a lot of crop tours taking shape across the U.S. And as they do, they're going to be reporting back some yield numbers. I would just tell everyone listening to not be surprised if they start to hear these national yield numbers be on the higher side of average. In other words, I do not think we had enough widespread massive damage in the Western Corn Belt to peel back the numbers. And if an August comes in with cooler conditions, and like you said, we do pick up some rain in some key areas, you can put a lot of weight in that crop late. And I think that's going to be a very important thing to watch going through the rest of the month of August.
Now, here in Champaign County, I'm pretty certain there were more than one Brazilian tour, speaking of crop tours, but this would be Brazilian farmers and others. There was one on campus. I think you had a different one at Nutrien, right?
Yeah, we did. We had about 50 of our folks from Brazil, all over Brazil, up here this week. And I got a chance to talk to them. And it was interesting. They asked some questions about U.S. numbers. And so we kind of shared. But I said, I'll share this with you as long as you answer these two questions for me. And so I asked the first big question. I said, hey, will you be expanding acreage this year? And the question was answered with a resounding no. They said that the likelihood of continuing on a 2-4% increase in total acreage was going to be minimized this year, and that there's going to be a pullback on putting a lot of new acres into production. And new acres that go into production, they commented, will likely be, they'll put crop in some of those acres, but probably not be able to invest in it based upon what they shared with me. And then the second thing was all about El Nino. And I said, what's your general feeling about El Nino? What do you think? And I said, because before I show you the research and statistics on it, I want to hear what you think. And they basically, they said the same thing I did. That is, they tend to be a bit drier north, Mato Grosso, even Mato Grosso do Sul, but Goiás, these big growing areas in the center west, the Cerrado. And then they say it tends to be wetter south, which it's already been extremely wet across the south. And I confirmed, I said, listen, I know you can still grow a big crop on half your normal rainfall in parts of the center west. But if you are planting late because it's too wet south and too dry north, do you think that that is a scenario that could happen this year? And the consensus was yes. They're concerned about the speed at which they get the crop in. And then we're going to have to watch southern Brazil, I think, for most of this upcoming growing season with being too wet because of El Nino. And man, Todd, this El Nino, it's not messing around. It is already on pace to be the strongest El Nino on record long before it even reaches its peak. So we've got a lot coming our way, and the El Nino is going to start to really drive the story the farther we go into fall.
I bet I see you at State Fair. Thank you for being with us today. Appreciate
you
it.
You bet. <That's Eric laughs> I'll be there.
That's Eric Snodgrass. He is with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report on this Friday afternoon. If you can stay with us, you'll hear our Commodity Week program up next. If not, it's online right now at WILLAG.org.